virtue equals abstaining from pleasure? The Bible's full of stories of feasting and drinking and dancing. Some start out that way and then go wrong. Others end that way happily. Throughout the book, there's all sorts of this kind of thing. Pleasure being seen as good and natural, as from God. People getting married and spending days having sex and having kids and hanging out and building things and taking journeys together. Jesus' first miracle, done before his serious ministry had really quite commenced and done almost prematurely, was to use a divine miracle to ensure that guests at a wedding who drank all the wine ordered for the occasion did not have to stop drinking yet. Yet growing up, we had really funny attitudes to pleasure in general. For example, I was always taught that we should interpret any and all references to wine in the Bible as symbols of joy and celebration. And yet people who actually drank wine in terms of celebration in real life were seen as dubious, self-indulgent, unchristian people who didn't really listen to God. People who might partake in a brawl at any moment and then cheat on their wife with someone else's. Maybe play cards too, or vote. A beer bottle found in the ditch in front of our place always had kind of a sinister aura to it. It was so alien, it might as well have dropped out of the sky. Because Christians didn't drink beer. It wasn't of God. Wine either, actually, except at church, and never hard liquor. We weren't, after all, Taylor Hale's brethren. All this always seemed odd to me on the few occasions when I actually thought about it. But of course, it felt entirely normal when I felt about it, because it was all I knew. Whatever you are used to is normal to you, and nothing else is. We were taught that God loved us, but our main experience of God was through dour old folks who didn't have any hobbies besides going to church and being ever vigilant as to us beloved young people. They were always warning us, quick with fear and caution and disapproval, teaching us to be full of care and anxiety about absolutely everything, mostly anything that would hurt our church status or be a bad testimony. Especially anything that might bring pleasure of any kind. And all this, too, seemed odd when I thought about it, but felt normal when I felt about it. Shelley says,
"This is how to kill a child from the inside out. Sometimes I do get angry about it."
Now that I think about it, me too. The Catholics list 7 deadly sins. You know? Pleasure taken too far? We had oddly divided attitudes about each of those sins, too. And for every 10 people who can name the 7 deadly sins, how many people can name their counterparts the 7 virtues? Try it. No one much knows what they are. Answer: the 7 Catholic virtues are really nothing more than the capacity to simply not do the sins. Nothing positive, really, just not doing the sins. Look it up. And many of us, Baptists, Pentecostals, Roman Catholics, and brethren, we're raised with the idea that virtue, good, is nothing more than simply avoiding doing bad. That's all it was felt we needed to be taught about good. Good was the absence of evil. To me, that sounds oddly like teaching children that if you want chocolate, what you need is a bucket of water. If you diligently remove each and every bit of grit and impurity in that bucket of water, eventually, of course, you will have a bucket of purest chocolate because you've removed every single thing that shouldn't be in chocolate from that bucket, every possible impurity. It just has to result in really, really pure chocolate, you see? And that's missing something. You can't make chocolate simply by removing everything that doesn't belong in chocolate from a bucket of water. And you can't make virtue by removing vice. You can't make people good by removing bad. I think there needs to be a term for this dysfunctional attitude and approach, and I'm not aware of one. I think I shall call it subtractive Christianity. Trying to do and be good just by removing what are seen as impurities, but not really adding anything of worth either. Our focus was on using our weekly meetings as what Dallas Willard calls sin management, like Alcoholics Anonymous. Spoilers. Being spiritual is being connected to and being fed by heaven, not just cutting oneself off from and not feeding upon things on earth. It's not even limited to feeding ourselves upon the Bible and Christian things. It's being freely given grace directly from God, stuff from heaven, on an ongoing basis. To do less is to slowly fall into chaos and watch our best Christian things fall apart and die. And that's what was happening to us and to our meeting. Thing is, even people not raised to be Christians grow up with these seven deadly sins in their cultural consciousness. When I teach creative writing courses, I teach kids that with children's shows especially, to give each individual Smurf or Elf or teenager or pony a personality, you just have to give each one a deadly sin. One is wrathful, one is greedy, one vain, one slothful, one a glutton, and one is some children's version of lustful. They do not each get a virtue. I think that's very telling. Families who did good things. There were some brethren families who I heard of doing charity work. There were some families who traveled to far countries to preach about the Bible. I know of a brethren man so characterized by charity work that he received a medal of recognition from the Lieutenant Governor of Nova Scotia. But that wasn't most of us. I can tell you now, though, that the people I speak to today who grew up in families who, in addition to judging all the alleged wickedness around them, also fed and clothed poor and hungry people, who didn't just sit in the church and preach in there, but took it to the streets and other countries, these people turned out, in almost every case, to be far healthier than the rest of us. But for the most part, our assemblies were places to hide from, rather than groups which made positive marks upon, the communities in which they were found. Louisa writes,
I have a close girlfriend, an atheist. She often asks me questions about religion, as she calls it. I hate that term. Last week she asked me, what does the meeting, she said, your church, do in the community? I said, nothing. That was a big turnoff for her.
Mary laughingly writes that
at least the meeting hall had the prettiest yard on the block.
I believe her meeting hall was in an industrial park, which may add some perspective to that statement. Melody writes,
I am unaware of any difference made when I was a kid. I did invite a few friends to the Monday night kids thing, or they would have heard the gospel, but I don't know if it impacted them at all. One friend did tell me later he thought it was incredibly boring.
Darlene's father tried to save the souls of her teachers by giving them the gospel. She says,
My father regularly felt it was his duty to tell my teachers that they were sinners and on their way to hell. It was done in a very offensive manner. The results were unkind behavior from the teachers towards me, which made my school year more difficult.
Ruth agrees, saying,
The only concrete difference I can think of that our church culture made in the surrounding community was that we gave them something amusing to speculate about. We were a culture that kept very much to ourselves, met in a brown meeting room with unpaved parking lot and no running water until the year 2000, and because of the air of mystery surrounding us, the local people liked to tell wild stories about our services, in which we sacrificed rabbits and chickens. Our meeting room was located next to a farm, and most of our members were farmers. We didn't contribute to helping the community around us. The most we did was open our doors for 1 week in the summer for gospel tent work, our version of vacation Bible school. Back in the 80s, we got plenty of outside participation from neighborhood kids, but by the time I left, almost no one but Gathered Saints kids were showing up to learn the memory verses and sing the action songs.
But some families didn't merely try to evangelize. Some actually gave food and things to poor people. Some were a listening ear in time of trouble for their neighbors and coworkers. Some connected on a human level instead of from a Christian platform. And I think those people knew, shared, and enjoyed God in a way none of the rest of us did. The funny thing is, these kind souls weren't ever the ones running things. They weren't the ones being pointed to as examples. They weren't winning the piety pageant we had going on. They just did this stuff quietly, and no one much knew about it. They needed stuff from God to give to people, and God gave them that stuff.